For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Welcome to Believe Knicks episode 8. I am Matthew Miranda, joined as always by Stacey Patton. We join you after an interesting 3-day span for the Knicks. On Thursday, there was the 25-point comebacking RJ Barrett buzzer beating 108-105 win over the Celtics. And then in the rematch tonight in Boston, probably the less said the better, 99-75 Boston. It's the fewest points the Knicks have scored in a game since April of 2018, I think it is. An ugly game, an interesting week. We are here to discuss. Stacey Patton, how are you? What's new with you?
Doing good. Staying mellow. With the W, actually.
Yeah, we will. We may get through an episode without talking about Carmelo Anthony. We'll see.
But in this sense, I mean it in the literal sense. I think we just went 1-1 against a pretty good team. Mm-hmm. I'm not wallowing in this loss. So,
yeah, I mean, all things considered, given how the season has gone, I'm glad they won a home game, a big home game for once. I think they've already shown they can be competitive on the road, but it would be nice to see the Knicks start to reestablish Madison Square Garden as a home court advantage. So a couple changes in today's game from last time. We'll talk a little bit about today's game and then get to some other subjects. Evan Fournier was benched by Adam Silver for crimes against Boston. He's just too good against them. A 41-point explosion on Thursday. He tied J.R. Smith's team record for the most threes in a game. Also, J.R. Smith was the last Knick to hit a buzzer beater. He was, in fact, the last two buzzer beaters because he hit one in Phoenix and Charlotte in 2013. So shout out to J.R. Smith for getting a lot of attention last night. But Fournier unavailable today with a contusion in his left thigh, I believe. So yep. Emmanuel quickly started in the backcourt with Alec Burks, which was exciting and interesting to see for those who have been clamoring to see IQ in the starting lineup. He's been playing really well, I feel, of late on both ends. What'd you think of Quickly's performance tonight? In a game where really pretty much all the Knicks struggled, I thought Quickly stood out as having like a pretty effective game. As effective as you can be in a game that you lose by 24.
Yeah, I mean, look, they got off to a hot start. Part of that was Quickly's hot shooting. But he was moving. One thing that's underrated with Quickly is that he moves really well without the ball. And one thing I noticed today is this is not me blaming Randle, but I think because everyone tends to defer a little bit more when Randle's on the floor, again, not saying it's because of him, that's just kind of, it seems like a resting state. Quickly himself, I think that he moves a lot better on the court when he's playing with Rose and the bench than he does with the starters. And maybe that could be also those are more important possessions, slow down, whatever. Today, like from the start, he was moving, he was a ball of energy. So it wasn't, a lot of it was not about Emmanuel Quickly, the point guard. A lot of it was him just, like how much his activity on offense was opening things up for other ones. Like his first assist, he made a backcourt cut. Julius found him. And then he just had a quick dump off touch pass to Mitch. Right. Great pass, but not, you know, not the point guard quote unquote things. Right. But overall, he ran the offense really well. He had a great balance working with Julius. I really, that first quarter offense is like kind of a gold standard for, you know, for what the Knicks could be. And as someone who's been clamoring for Quickly to start, certainly last year, right now, I don't think he needs to start over Kemba for sure. There's an argument he should start over Fournier. We can discuss that. But I think it shows that he's ready for the moment. And this is what people have been questioning, right? He's a bench guy. He's just maybe one day he can be Lou Williams, but he's not a point guard and all that. And I think he showed both that he's ready for it and where he has work to do. And I think where he has work to do is where the entire Knicks team is missing something, which is someone who can get to the rim at volume, right? The Knicks actually made more three-pointers than the Celtics and shot basically the same percentage. I think one team was like, I think it was like 40 and 39. I think the Knicks might have been 40%. So both teams shot the ball well from three, but the Knicks actually shot a worse percentage from two, at least before garbage time. I didn't check the box score. It was pretty much a garbage score for us. I didn't check the box score after the beginning of garbage time. But at that point, the Knicks were actually shooting worse from two, and that's not a Quickley's fault. But it shows you two things, right? Because they always have a big who can't score in the paint, that kind of limits driving lanes. And because they have very few guys who can just get there anyway, even with just a pick and roll or something, like who are the guys that can score at the rim consistently? It's really Randall and Rose. RJ's inefficient there. Quickley Mitchell, can't get there that often.
If you want to call that scoring.
He needs someone to set him up, right?
True. Yeah, no, and very so, true, very true.
Right, so in the perimeter, it's really just Rose and Randall. Kemba's better at it than Quickley, but that's what the Knicks are missing as a team, and that's the thing. They have so many good, talented guards, and there was a while, you know, when they had Frank Ntilikina, Elfrid Payton, and the year before all of the moves, right? That year, like Randall's first year, it was kind of the opposite problem. They didn't have shot makers, but they had a ton of guys that could, even Moutier could get to the rim, right? Mm-hmm. Now they have kind of the opposite problem where they have a bunch of really talented shot makers, smart players who can create, but they just lack that. And then once Boston figured it out, that kind of, it made the Knicks offense a little bit predictable. But again, I'm not disappointed in this. Because here's the thing, right? Look at the Celtics starting lineup. You have Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, two all-star caliber players, right? But, I mean, if we're being honest, you can have a very high opinion of Julius Randle and still think Jaylen Brown's better than him. Mm-hmm. We know Jason Tatum is. So they have two guys that are arguably better than anyone on the Knicks team. So one guy who's without a doubt is, I would probably say Jaylen Brown is too. You have Robert Williams, who has this year emerged into a center that's more consistent than Mitchell Robinson, although I didn't think Mitchell played that bad tonight. Mm. You have Marcus Smart, who is a veteran winning player. And then you have Horford, right? Veteran winning quality above average player. Like, that's a really good starting five.
Yeah.
And then you take into account the Knicks were playing with eight men. They didn't have Kemba or Rose. They didn't have Fournier, who against this team is a big addition. I think there are a lot of people freaking out about the effort, but effort tends to follow when you know you're kind of in a tough situation. They put up a fight in the first half. They played really well, but in the end, talent won out. And when that final punch came, I think the Knicks kind of realized that the odds were against them and you'd like them to keep fighting, but you can also understand it on a night like tonight. And they stole one, so they're still, as you posted, 19 and 21. I focus more on tonight. We can talk about the night before, I think, with that RJ shot. That's worth living. But those are kind of my thoughts on where we are now. It's like we know the limitations. We know what we have. And Quickley had an encouraging night, and I think he's growing into what can be a really good point guard. But we saw both why there's reason to be enthusiastic and why he's, what he still has to do.
Mm-hmm. To your point, and this was definitely influenced by the Knicks playing some of their starters fairly late into the game, but this was a game where it was the unusual game, and the Knicks are shorthanded, as everybody is, but maybe the breakdown just affected them differently. This was the rare case where the Knicks bench like really contributed nothing. Quentin Grimes hit two threes. Other than that, the bench didn't have a single point. Boston's reserves had 33. I don't recall maybe one of the game this year where the Knicks bench has been just like that thoroughly outscored. Which also to your point about the first quarter offense, it sounded to me, if I'm correct, that you saw some of what was happening in the early going is like kind of maybe what you've been waiting for. There was a lot of the Knicks were hitting threes. They were getting good looks at threes. Randall in particular, I thought early on, was doing a wonderful job of penetrating off and going at Horford. and kicking out not to the obvious recipient, but to, in a lot of cases, like the best recipient, the recipient who would have been open one pass through swinging the ball around. The Knicks looked great in the first quarter. Offensively, they hit 7 threes, but I was concerned when the first ended because they had 26 points and 21 of them were on threes. And I feel like that first quarter was like fun and positive in a lot of ways, but I feel like the Knicks have become too three-point happy, where I feel like almost the only way the Knicks can win a game now is to outshoot their opponent from three. And that's not unique to the Knicks. That's basically like where the league is altogether. I looked the last two nights. Miami hadn't finished their game yet, but right before we went on, I looked at the last 14 games in the NBA, and the team that has more threes made has won 10 of them. The team that had the better percentages, like the three is obviously the dominant, you know, coin of the realm, whatever. But do you think the Knicks, as great as the first quarter looked, do you see any other way this team identity wise wins games other than outshooting their opponents like from three? Because they're not, I don't feel like generally their defense has been better, but I don't feel like the Knicks are winning games because of their defense or because they get to the line or because of their ball movement. I feel like it's threes. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that is, I think I'm starting after tonight. I'm like, they are about 500 all said and done.
Mm-hmm.
They're not that different from last year. So I think as much as, I mean, I don't know what they're ranked in defensive rating now, but you know, they're still an elite rim protection team and those kind of things. Right. So like defense is still part of their identity, even though they have a lot more atrocious performances than they did last year.
Coming into this game, their defensive rating was 18th, which is up. Oh, Basketball Reference, this is 18.
It's 20th now on NBA.com.
They probably which I think is actually an improvement from where it was earlier in the season, but still not something to hang your hat on.
Yeah, so what they can hang their hat on even now is rim protection. They're still the second best team in the league to rim protection to Cleveland, who is an assembly line of 7-footers. So, you know, that's still something they can hang their hat on. The other thing I would say is I don't necessarily think that has to be the case. They have to outshoot. I think that they have to, like, not shoot 25% from three or 20% from three. But if they just shoot 34% but get enough threes up, that should be enough. Mm-hmm. Provided, like, I think the fact that lately it's really seemed like that is more speaks to how little pressure the Knicks can put on the rim without a player named Derrick Rose. I think it's even more exaggerated when you don't have Kemba Walker. I think that's why the games where RJ Barrett has been aggressive, it's really notable, even when he doesn't shoot well, how much it opens up the Knicks' offense. Because you know, teams know, like, we know how teams are going to defend the Knicks. They're going to key in on Randall, and they're going to trust the fact that the other Knicks players are not going to be able to make anything happen if you close out on them, right? So all you have to do is close out, is make Randall's pass difficult, and if he passes, make it so that the closeout isn't that hard. RJ has taken advantage of that. Fournier did a good job of just hitting a lot of contested shots, quickly has hit contested shots, and he will play off it. The problem with Quickly is he can't get quite all the way to the rim. That's really it. Like, I don't think, like, people talk about Quickly's not quote unquote a point guard. He shows a lot of good point guard instincts.
I agree with you.
There was a possession in the last game. This is a very tiny thing, but I'm specifically calling this out as opposed to, you know, some spectacular lob to Mitch. But there was this possession last game where Obi got a switch. Obi posted up, smaller defender on Boston, and Quickly threw him the bounce pass, right? That's a pass that Knicks guards haven't made this year.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like just that's a point guard understanding matchups and understanding where to get it, right? Mm-hmm. I think his vision is good. I think he's an accurate passer. I think the bigger problem is when they know that there's an area of the court, when any defense knows there's an area of a court you can't threaten, it limits what you can do. That works. That goes for point guards who can attack the rim but can't shoot. You know, like an Alfred. I'm not saying Quickly's problem is as much as Elfrid Payton, but whenever you can't threaten everything or keep defenses honest, that happens. Yeah. That happens to quarterbacks in football, right? So I think that's the bigger issue for Quickley than, like, I think he's a good enough passer and, you know, IQ guy, to put it, to take the very low hanging fruit there. For that. But from what I was saying before, are the Knicks 3-point dependent? They don't have to be more so than any other team. But I think it's or not too much more so than any other team, but they are a little bit on that end of the spectrum. And what has made it really feel that way is the fact that that Derrick Rose has been out and Kemba Walker has been out, but especially Rose, because there isn't another guard on the team who, like, you can just give him the ball at the 3-point line and he'll get to the rim.
Mm-hmm.
And we're missing Rose. And I think at you know, there were people who, when he got diagnosed with the injury, people were like, well, maybe the Knicks should tank now, right? Because it's that devastating a blow. Mm-hmm. He is the second most vital player, if you ask many people, the most vital player on the Knicks. And we don't make the playoffs. We probably don't make the playoffs without him last year. We certainly don't end up at fourth.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Knicks are struggling through right now.
Yeah, Rose got an MVP last year, which was mildly controversial, but like he had an enormous impact.
You said he got an MVP last year?
He got one MVP vote last year.
Right?
Yeah. And like, whatever. I mean, it made some sense. There's a lot of people who deserve one MVP vote. I was really surprised by that, but like I think you saw when Randall was out, Randall is irreplaceable. You know, the Knicks don't have a hub like him on offense, but after him, or maybe up there with him, Rose definitely seems to be the next, and Mitch, I would say. Those are probably the most, whether you think they're the best or they're not, they're probably the most uniquely irreplaceable. Speaking about Quickley, he made a point about his vision, and something I've seen him doing this much more this season than I saw last season, and I think, relatedly, I'm seeing the Knicks do it more this season, which is last season, than last season. The Knicks have been really awful for a while at not feeding the ball to mismatches. Like, when the Knicks guards spot a mismatch, like, you know, it might raise an eyebrow and that's it. Quickley, particularly in transition, it's happened a lot with Obi, but it's also happened with Taj. He'll spy he's 60 feet from the basket, half court, and sees that there's a Nick big in the paint with a small guy in front of him. And the Knicks already in 40, whatever it is, 40 games this year, I feel, have thrown ahead more to bigs in transition who have someone pinned than they did all of last season in 72 games. And like, I don't think Quickley doesn't have, you know, the vision of Chris Paul or Mark Jackson or somebody like that, but I don't think they need that. And I think what's really particularly impressed me of late with Quickley, I'm never really sure about him offensively. Like, he does a lot of things nicely, but like, I don't know where he is going to end up on that end, but I've been really happy this year to see his play on the defensive end. And I feel like especially of late, when the Knicks were winning games, which they had won 5 of 7 before tonight, Quickley was a big part of that on both ends, not just scoring and passing, but also deflecting, things he could do on the perimeter and the passing lanes. He's been a really bright spot on both ends of the floor.
Yeah, I mean, when I evaluated Quickley in college, one thing that puzzled me was that he won SEC Player of the Year. So he was a terrific player in college. And it was interesting because he was neither the team's leading, the main offensive gun, that was Ashton Hagans, and Tyrese Maxey was the more ballyhooed prospect, although they actually didn't go that far from each other in the draft. Maxey went 21st after being mocked in the lottery most of the year. Side note, if you've watched the Sixers at all, he's making that 21st pick look very ridiculous, as his teammate Quickley is with the 25th pick, right? But Quickley was known as, he was kind of their glue guy, who was probably their best shooter and probably their best defender. And he was an elite defender. He was SEC all defense. But one thing I noticed was that despite the fact that he has like a 6'10 wingspan, he didn't get a lot of steals in college. And that's one thing, because when you evaluate prospects, you're looking for, like, you know, even if you haven't completely figured the game out, when you're playing against a lot of guys who are not going pro in sports and you're a future NBA player, you should be racking up the things that your athleticism and just, I am just 99.99 percentile, and you're, if still 99 percentile, that's an order of magnitude lower than me, right, in this distribution, I should be able to dominate. And one of those things is steals, right? That's what we've seen. And he wasn't racking up a ton of those. And I think part of that is he's generally been a defender that is more focused on positional defense, being in the right spot. And we saw that last year. And I think last year he had his ups and downs on defense. By the end of the year, I legitimately thought he was one of the Knicks' better perimeter defenders. Mm-hmm. You know, probably not as good as RJ or Reggie, but I certainly thought he was a better, by the end of the year, better defender than Elfrid Payton. I thought he was a better defender than some of the other guards. But he still wasn't doing, you know, he still wasn't hopping passing lanes. And that's something he's really, I think, looked at. His steal rate hasn't gone up. It's still 1.4 compared to 1.2 last year. So, but I think if I were to look at the deflection stats, I would imagine he gets a lot more of those. He's been more aggressive, and he's stronger now too. So I think that's part of it. Like, there's not, if he gambles and he, you know, even like we talk about just getting bodied, but sometimes another thing we don't talk about as much is like when you're weaker or when you're not as strong, being out of position is that much more impactful, right? Because like every inch that you can have, if you give it up or if you give up the leverage, it's just way worse for you. And he has that now. So I think you're seeing that. I think that guy's going to be a terrific defender. I think he already is a really good one. I think part of the reason that you didn't see Deuce play as much, and we can talk about that, because I thought he should have played a little bit more, because just because it seemed like IQ and Burks got a lot of minutes that maybe they could have reduced that load. But I think a lot of people were like, McBride is a different level of defender from Quickly. And in some ways, I get it. It's like, but, you know, it's like, I know you're not a huge football fan, but it's like, you know, when you see like there are cornerbacks who are just always making plays, always kind of loud and like beating the crap out of receivers, kind of like Deion Sanders. And I'm not talking about, I'm not saying he was over, like, I'm not specifically talking too much about shit talking or all that. I'm just saying like they're always involved. And then you have cover corners who just never get thrown at. And who are just like always in there. And that's kind of what Quickly is compared to McBride. I like having both.
Right.
And I would say McBride does have a little bit of a higher ceiling, but I think the gap between them as defenders is a lot smaller than people realize. If there is a gap, I think you can trust Quickly probably to do his job more often than McBride, just because McBride's a rookie. Quickly went through that last year. But no, he's after Burks, he's probably the Knicks' best guard defender, right? And if you're considering RJ a guard, then him too. But
right
after Burks, I would say Quickly is the best defender. Like Grimes and McBride probably have slightly more potential than him long term because of the size, but right now he's the best of that group.
Yeah, I don't feel bad when I see Quickly lined up in a big spot defensively. Like, I feel okay. Like, he's gonna give you a chance. Does Quickly remind you of anybody? I was thinking about this, like, so many players, you can see someone in their game, like, you know, pretty quickly, no pun there. But like, I think part of my issue with Quickly is like, he has aspects of a lot of players. Like, he's always compared to Lou Williams, and I don't see that at all. Lou Williams, I think, was a much better one-on-one. Quickly has a great handle, but Lou Williams was more of that kind of a scorer. I can't think of a player that I've ever seen who Quickly rings to mind. Quickly to me is like unique. And I don't feel like any individual aspect of his game is like, he's not a great 3-point shooter. Like, he's okay. And at the volume that he shoots, like, it's worth it, but this isn't like Steve Novak or Hubert Davis, you know, from the perimeter. His floater game is not, it's not like incredibly efficient. It's not like, oh my God, like, the Quickly floater is like the Kareem Skyhook. Like, it's not that reliable at all. He, like you say, he's not a playmaker on defense, and he's not a Darrell Revis cover too. Like, he's not someone who, like, you're never going to go at. Like, you're going to go at him. I can't think of anyone that Quickly reminds me of. Does he remind you of anybody, or are there any parts of his game that bring specific people to mind for you?
Yeah, I mean, I will say the puns are, just I'll answer your question, but like, the puns are almost unavoidable at this point. And it's gotten so, like, my phone actually autocorrects the actual word, like, I'm coming quickly, will autocorrect, puts an E in there.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, I mean, I get where the Lou Williams comps come from. He's, like, a skinny, wiry guy. I think wiry is a better term, because I think IQ is actually pretty strong. And I think Lou Will is strong, pretty strong for that matter, too, and probably an underrated defender. But Lou Williams, to your point, yeah, I mean, at his peak, certainly, he had much more of the bag, if you will. And he's just more threatening around the rim. And quickly still developing those games, developing those parts of his game. I think it's fair to say he has Lou Williams in his game. Yeah. Just a primary scorer who can make the right reads and is a good enough ball handler. I think at times Lou Williams has been a good defender in his career. I think quickly can be that. It's funny, out of college, I thought he could grow into something like Pat Beverly, to be honest. And now that is not the kind of comp I would use for him.
Yeah, yeah.
By any means. Honestly, the closest player in the league right now, have you watched the Nuggets much this year?
Some.
Have you seen a guy named Bones Highland at all?
Or wanted the Knicks to draft Bones. My heart wanted Bones Highland. My brain couldn't make sense of it. I was like, you don't need Derrick Rose and Quickly and Burks and Bones Highland. But, like, my God, I wanted that dude.
Yeah, I mean, I love Grimes.
He's like Lou Williams to me. He reminds me of Lou Williams.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in some ways, because he's better at getting to the rim. That was one thing. Like, whenever I was talking about Bones, everyone's like, well, you already have Quickly. And they are freakishly similar players. Like, the release is the same. They'll both pull up from, like, wherever. I think they're friends too, so they've talked about you know, that similarity. They both have a similar type of handle. They were both really skinny coming out of college. Bones is a little bit better at getting to the rim, but in terms of the general form of the game, that's kind of what it looks like, right? It's loosey goosey, yeah, out in space, can pull up from anywhere, kind of a low release, which forces you to do other things, but really heady on defense. There's also a lot of similarities. Bones actually was. He was more of a steals guy. He was kind of the opposite of IQ statistically on defense because he was asked to do, he was basically asked to carry VCU's offense. You know, he did not do much on defense, but one thing he did do is hop passing lanes. Mm-hmm. And he actually, I remember the one game I watched him against Deuce, and that was a fun battle. And I ended up falling in love with both those prospects. But there was one game where he really tricked Deuce because he was on the wing and Deuce ran, I think it was either pick and roll or he just beat his guy. But Bones actually stunted to act like he was going to help. Yeah. And then he fooled Deuce. And I can't blame Deuce for the read because it really looked like he was coming. But he was able to sell the fake so hard because Bones and IQ both have these long wingspans. And that was when I was like, all right, he might get beat a lot on defense. He might be lazy sometimes. But that's high-level thinking and execution. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a great combo. Bones is a guy, a lot of people have said Jamal Crawford, for some of the same reasons you said with Lou Williams. I think that there is some trepidation. There's parts of a lot of guys. I see some Tony Parker with the the floater game, not just the floater game, but he's added this year. I think I tweeted this before, but what I said in Quickly's rookie year was, after this year, during the summer, lock him in a room with a bench and lots of weights and as much Tony Parker and Steve Nash film as you can find. Not to say he's exactly like Steve Nash. He's a little bit more similar to Parker, but they were both excellent finishers at the rim, and yes, neither of them could jump over a phone book because they could. And Quickly has done that. Those, like, he had a big one against Boston last game where it was technically a jump shot, but it's from 1 foot away. And because he released, he didn't take the floater like they expected him to. He didn't take a layup. It was kind of an in-between the floater and the layup.
And he's been wrong-footing a lot of his floaters recently.
Exactly. And that was a Tony Parker. It was especially a Steve Nash staple, but Tony Parker used it a lot. And that's – so he reminds – I will say – and that's to say he's as good as Tony Parker, but he reminds me a lot of Parker. And if folks remember, Parker drove Popovich crazy early in his career. Like, it took time for him to become who he was. He also had a lot of things to polish in his game. So I'll go with Tony Parker with the caveat that I'm not saying he's going to be that good, and I'm not underrating the career of someone I think is a certain Hall of Famer. So
yeah. when they were in 03, when the Spurs were winning their second title with Duncan, there was the kind of canonical belief when they were playing the Nets in the finals was that they were going to trade Parker, I think, do like a sign and trade for Jason Kidd. I think it was Jason Kidd.
When they had George Hill, or is this before then?
Before that. Yeah, before that. It's 03.
They also thought about trading Parker when George Hill like played really well for them.
Yeah, I'm saying like Tony Parker is this Hall of Fame, you know, point guard who's a key part of four championships. And in 03, they were going to trade him like for a sure thing. So I think quickly is similar in the vein of you have this player who's like very talented, but like when you said that, when you talked about how they'll pull up from anywhere, I think the reason the Knicks never would have drafted Bones Highland. Yeah.
Here's the other thing. I will say I know that Parker wasn't a great 3-point shooter. So his inside the arc game reminds me a little bit of Parker could be, but sorry, go ahead.
No, just if the Knicks had drafted Highland and had two players pulling up from where they do, like Thibodeau would literally like be medically out of the league. So I think there was no way where they were taking Bones Highland. Last note on quickly, kind of off the courtish more, but again along the same line of does he bring anyone to mind or is he unique? I can't think of. I have a hard time coming to a quick idea of any Nick I can remember who has been as popular from the beginning as quickly, and it really has never gone away. Like people were very happy. People were pretty happy, I think, to get him, particularly at 25th after all the moves. By the time preseason wasn't even over, and quickly was a fan favorite because he put up like enormous lines in the preseason against like Detroit and Cleveland. He was a fan favorite all season. He's still loved this year. I would say more loved because he's earned it because he's playing better. He's improving. Can you think of any Nick? Like, I don't feel like Porzingis was as popular on draft night as quickly was, at least at their spot.
But for sure not.
You know, so, you know, first of all,
by the time peak Porzingis was pretty popular. That's a good,
who's the last player? Like maybe Barrett, but I don't feel like Barrett's ever been as loved as quickly. Like, the last player the Knicks drafted who was that universally acclaimed, like from the beginning, like basically from draft, like at his spot, you know, from there to instantly like preseason darling to impressive rookie to improves in second year. Like, I think I might be missing someone, but like, I think you have to go pretty far back.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Those are tight conditions, right? Because you're basically at that point ruling out any lottery pick because the expectations are just too high for them. That's why you would say that quickly has what you would call unconditional love, whereas RJ has what you would call unconditional. You would call conditional love. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. There's guys who are going to defend him to his death, but the reality is he was the third pick in the draft, where the top two was a generational player who, when he's been healthy, has been that. And another generational player now in Ja Morant. Yep, so that's just a tough. And then Darius Garland went right after RJ, and he's been like, you get picked third. That's just the way it is. It's tough to like quickly fits a lot of checks, a lot of boxes there, right? Where he overperformed his draft spot as a 25th pick. I mean, it's worth what, like, if Draymond Green had the career he did but got taken first overall, is he as beloved? Mm-hmm. I don't know, right? And then I'm not comparing quickly to Draymond Green, and I'm not saying he hasn't had a great career. What I'm saying is has Draymond Green had a great career for a first-round pick? Maybe if you look at the numbers and you did kind of an expected value, you would find that he has, and I personally think he has. But if there was a first overall pick. If he was a first overall pick, you expect those guys to be superstars, right? But part of the reason he's beloved is he did go 35th. And I think that's helped quickly. It's helped him more than guys like Obi or Barrett. I think there's just an audacity to his game beyond that that makes a lot of difference. Here's what I'll pose to you, though. When we're comparing him to other players, So this is not a person I normally tend to pay much attention to, but he's mentioned this a few times, and I do think it's an interesting comp. So Tommy D has mentioned that Quickly reminds him of Starks. Do you see that a lot? I was very young and I didn't analyze the game the way I do now. When so I'm actually from, my hometown is where John Starks lives and has lived since the 1990s. He used to host a basketball camp with Doc Rivers there. And I went to it as a kid. So John Starks was one of my favorite players growing up. Probably before Sprewell got there. Sprewell, I think, replaced John Starks as my favorite Nick at that time. But I'm at like first team. So I love John Starks. But I didn't have the same critical eye towards his game as I do, you know, with someone like Quickly. Do you see that comparison at all?
Yeah, I see similarities. I see similarities in that they're both, I think, shooting guard. It means less now than it did then. But one of the real great benefits of Starks was the defensive versatility he brought, but also, you know, Starks in his best year with the Knicks led the team in assists, had, I think, close to 7, definitely over 6 a game. Like, he could pass. And I think Quickly, like Starks, he brings you a versatility. You could play John Starks with a lot of different kinds of guards. And I love that about Quickly. You can put Quickly with, we've seen what he can do with Derrick Rose. He's had moments with Burks, he's had moments. Even
Oh, you're talking about guards? Yeah, sir. Yeah.
Oh, but yeah, but certainly with all kinds of players. He's a real spark. The way that Starks was, he is a presence on both ends. He's not at the Starks level at all defensively. But again, he's much younger than you know Starks was by the time Starks got to the Knicks. So give Quickly, you know, 5 more years of strength and conditioning. And yeah, there's a lot of ways that it makes sense. There is that audaciousness to their game. There is definitely that. So my dad is, I guess you could still say, is a minister. But growing up, like, he was a minister. And in my house, English and Spanish were both spoken. And one of the things that, like, I learned very quickly in life was that for some reason, like, cursing in English was not a thing that, like, you did. Like my grandmother literally on more than one occasion, like, literally washed my mouth out with a bar of soap. Like, you did not curse in my family in English, but in Spanish, like, you could curse. Like, somehow it was just a different set of rules. And I remember I also learned watching my dad used to play a lot of sports. Like, he was in a baseball league and he would play basketball, and I learned also, like, interestingly, you could curse in English if you were playing sports. That was the only time that cursing was okay in English. And then the first time I ever heard my father curse in English, like, in our house, was a game where the Knicks were down 1 to Atlanta. It was late in the 92 season, and the Knicks had a big lead all year over the Celtics in the division. And then late in the year, Boston won like 15 of 16, and the Knicks were collapsing, and my dad hates the Celtics, and there's all this drama, and there's this game in Atlanta, and the Knicks are down 1, and Starks gets the ball in the corner with 7 seconds, 8 seconds, like, plenty of time, and just launches a 3. And this is not the age when corner threes are statistically like the best. Like, it was a bad shot. You were down 1. There was time to drive. There was time to find Ewing. There was time to do all these things. And the moment Starks went into his motion, my father started cursing up a storm. And Starks, of course, missed the shot. So Quickly, I would say, is probably the Nick. I think Randall has the ugliest turnovers because they tend to happen when he's in a position offensively that it always triggers a fast break the other way. So, like, Randall's are frustrating because they always seem to me, like, if you can quantify, I don't know if anybody does this, but if you can quantify how many points someone's turnovers lead to on average, Randall definitely is among the league leaders. But
Yeah, he's not throwing them out of bounds. They're like strips into like odd man advantages, odd man rushes in hockey, I guess.
Quickly makes some very curious decisions. Like, Quickly is not a player that I am on his mental wavelength. Like, he does a lot of things that I don't get. They pay off. Like, as much as they don't hit, they hit. But Starks was like that also. Like, I think Quickly, it'd be very interesting to see where Quickly is in 5 years, because you know, Starks had such a different path, and broke in with the Knicks like basically right when they got good. So like totally different expectations and culture and everything. But it does make sense. I had never really thought of it before, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's I mean, he definitely is that kind of. That's the thing, like with the point guard thing with Quickly. Tibbs actually mentioned this in the post game, right? In the second half, he wanted him to be more aggressive. He wished Quickly had taken more control. I think part of, I mean, Quickly did play the most minutes. I think he even played more than Julius tonight. Or certainly second most after Julius. He played 36 minutes. I wonder how much fatigue plays a role in that. But I think for a player like that also, on a different wavelength, clearly can score in a variety of different ways. When you ask them to be a point guard, when you ask them to facilitate, when you ask them to do those things, finding that balance can be very tough. And I think you see, I think actually Quickly for a young player is quite good at it. I think he errs more on the side of slowing things down and being tentative than being too aggressive, to be honest. I think most people would disagree. But you can see that he's trying to do that. And that gets back to the old age old debate, right? It's like, you know, to quote the other guys, you got to let me fly, you know? So, I think he's, I agree. He's very much, he's a player that can be a point guard. I believe that. I believe he has the fortitude and mental acuity and all of that to be a point guard. I think he's a very smart, very high IQ player. And all of that. But the question is, do you like how much do you lose by having him rein it in? Ultimately, I think you want the ball in his hands. So I would feel like you can, he's a smart enough player to figure out how to rein it in the right amount. And for, again, for a second year player, I think he's pretty good at it. But that's where you're kind of seeing some of those adjustments. And it's fascinating to watch him grow in real time. And I will say, like, I think he's improved. I think Obi's taken a mass. Obi did not have a good game tonight, but I think Obi's taking a massive leap. You know, I think the rookies have looked good. I think the player development, this says a lot about them, right? Mitch had some weird stuff going on, but actually I've really enjoyed Mitch's play of late.
Yep.
Archie Barrett has been up and down, but there are micro skills that have been better this year. We should talk about, by the way, now that we're on RJ, we should talk about that shot. You know, I don't think, did you watch it live or
yes, I did.
You know, what were your thoughts on that? I mean, how do you, that's kind of the RJ, it's a microcosm of RJ Barrett's career, right? Because overall, he's not, you look at his overall stats and they're pedestrian, but you look at some of the things he does on a game-to-game basis, whether it's on defense, whether it's a timely drive, whether it's a banked in three at the buzzer. You know, yeah, just really want your thoughts on that and RJ in general.
The shot was, I was very in sync with this game, like watching it. Like I knew when shit was going in and like I knew when people, I'm calling missed free throws. Like I was very in on, I was very attuned with this game and I knew Tatum was going to score.
Fine. Sorry, but you didn't watch it live, right?
No, I did.
Oh, you did?
Okay, yeah, yeah. And I threw it into RJ. I don't know why. Like, if you were to narrate the game, or if I heard on the radio, you know, Barrett catches it, is falling to his right, launches a three. Like, I already know it's going to overtime. There's like zero chance RJ Barrett's making that shot. If I hear it, or if you read me a transcript of it. But watching it, like as soon as the ball left his hands, I knew it was going in. Now, this means nothing because I've known things were going to happen a million times that haven't happened. But I had actually, we had family visiting.
So you got like Apple stock in 1995?
We had family visiting, and one of them was someone who like doesn't really watch basketball at all, but like was very interested in the game because everybody else was watching it. And, you know, they're seeing this great game. Like everyone involved, you know, is emotionally committed to this Knicks Celtic national TV, you know, important game and this comeback and blah, blah, blah. And the Randall issue. And it was just so nice. And I always remember, I wonder if you remember this, Porzingis hit a game winner that they called off in Charlotte. His rookie season, there was a game down there and they inbounded it to KP and he hit like a 35 foot, like three. And they said it wasn't good. And I still think, I'm still pretty sure that like it should have counted, or there wasn't the enough. Yeah.
And then there's the Mari one, which is almost the exact same thing.
Yeah. So like, there's been all these like almost. But I remember both the last two game winners were both J.R. Smith. One, the first was in Charlotte, and the second was in Phoenix. And I remember the Phoenix game. I had recorded it. I missed it live, so I had recorded it, and I was so like happy that he made that shot. It was that you know, enchanted 2013 regular season that I remember I rebounded and watched the play like 50 times. Like I just thought it was so good. So when on MSG, they were like, oh, here's a clip of the last time the Knicks had a buzzer beater. That play, like I still remembered every single detail of like every movement on the court from watching it like 50. There's nothing like a game winner. I wish it didn't take the Knicks like once a decade to do it, but that was, I can only think of maybe that Trent Tucker, you know, 1/10 of a second three is against Chicago is the only other Knick game winner that comes right to mind. And I guess the David Lee tippin for just like sheer insanity of, you know, difficulty in a game winning shot.
Yeah, I mean, we've had like the Melo game tying three.
Allen Houston also, I should not overlook. Obviously, yeah. Allen Houston. Yeah, the Melo, which one against Chicago?
Yeah, that's the one I always remember. So. Mm-hmm. Here's another interesting thing with that. With Allen Houston, so this is, I think, something that is kind of a thing with Julius. Now I'm willing to say it at this point. It just seems like late in games, you cannot. He struggles with free throws, and I remember watching as a kid, Allen Houston. They would always show him go to the line. It's just not an always thing. Allen Houston overall was a clutch free throw shooter, but they would show him, and he would they would say 83-84% for the season, and Allen Houston. I remember several games where he missed both free throws in a clutch situation. Is that a thing, do you think? Or I mean, because like you want to say that, you know, nerves aren't really a thing. These are professionals and all of that. But like for some guys, it seems like Allen Houston is one of the best free throw shooters the Knicks have ever had. And I remember maybe this is my kid brain, you know, overweighting a few of those experiences. But it definitely felt like it was a thing. And it feels a little bit like it's a thing for Julius.
Nerves are absolutely a thing. Patrick Ewing had nerves. Patrick Ewing was not someone that you want. Patrick Ewing was like a 75% free throw shooter for his career. A lot of years he was maybe up around 78. He was a great shooter. You did not want Patrick Ewing at the line.
But Houston was even, I mean, first of all, am I remembering the Allen Houston stuff correctly? That's
what I don't remember. Allen Houston was like an 89, I would guess off the top of my head.
And I remember it a bunch of times where he missed like two in the clutch, like big ones.
I'm sure it happened. I don't remember it being like an issue.
Would you say it's an issue with Julius?
I don't think it's any more of an issue with Randall than it was with Ewing. Like, okay.
And he's probably closer to that level of shooter than he is Allen Houston.
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm more concerned with, you know, Barrett getting to 75% than whatever Randall's doing at this point. There's you know, the Knicks are probably the same as every other team. Like, I want their best shooters at the line, and Randall is not probably top five on the Knicks as far as shooters.
But he takes their technicals. That's kind of a funny
thing. He does. There may be a pecking order thing there going on. But like,
I think he's taking them with quickly on the floor, which is like, I get it. Like, maybe it helps him get his confidence up, or, you know, if he's going to be your closest all-star, like, I get boosting his scoring average, but like...
Maybe, but like... I was actually
quickly Fournier probably at least, right? Maybe even Rose.
I would take Fournier. I would take Burks over him. I would take Kemba. I would take Rose. I would take quickly. I would take just at the foul line. I would take.
I mean, Grimes is a rookie, so maybe not there.
Yeah, but... he's only 63% right now.
I mean, I feel like Grimes is better than a 63%.
I do too. But like, I can't. I'm not going to give it to Grimes yet. But even the fact that you can question like Quentin Grimes says something about where Randall is with that right now.
Yeah, like he shouldn't be taking our techs. I think is like
he should not. But I think if the Knicks were a better team, Randall's free throw shooting would not be like really something that we would probably notice that much. Maybe somewhat. If he's your best play, like he totally reminds me of Ewing, like in that regard, just in the regard of like at the line late in the game, I don't expect him to make both. I might expect it more from Randall than I did even from Ewing. Ewing missed a lot of free throws in big games.
That's true.
Speaking of the Knicks and free throws, I don't know how to do an analysis at all of this, but the Knicks have been. Rough.
Are you rhyming that on purpose?
Rough at the foul line. Going back to Christmas, they were like 5 of 12 against Atlanta. They have had some rough games. They were 5 of 12 against Atlanta, 6 of 16 against Minnesota, 12 of 22 against OKC last two nights, I think. 6 of 15 tonight, 10 of 15 in the win. Like, this team has some problems at the foul line.
Is that just
like a stretch of, you know, you have some bad games and so they'll be hot later, or because their team percentage for the year is fairly like middle of the pack.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to. So, like we mentioned, Rose has been out. They have had a lot of injuries. And so a lot of the guys who have been playing, the guys who just don't play that much often just don't shoot free throws that well. But you've had Quickly has missed time. Burks has missed time. Rose has missed a lot of time. Kemba's missed time. So a lot of their good free throw shooters have missed time. That's a big part of it. I mean, COVID is just a weird time for stats in general.
Yeah.
So I would attribute it more to that and then some randomness. But, I mean, there's been a debate in the analytics community, right? Is free throw defense a real thing? Now, you might say, that sounds ridiculous. You can't contest the free throw.
Patrick Beverly plays free throw defense.
Yeah. Well, aside from those games or J.R. Smith untying someone's shoes, you also have... I mean, free throw defense in the sense of you know who to foul, right? And there are some teams that are very good at knowing who to foul and when to foul, what situations and all of that. I don't think that's what's happened to the Knicks, personally. I think it's been more a lot of injuries, a lot of guys being out, and some randomness. If it persists, you know, we'll see.
So just to turn the knife a little bit more on the RJ Barrett draft, if you could have ended up with Zion or Ja, having seen what they are to this point, who would you rather have seen end up on the Knicks?
Yeah, I mean, I was very much at the time, there were people who were like, should we take Ja? And I always felt like they were being contrarians because I was all in on Zion as a generational prospect. I still think he can be that. I think Schwinn, for example, is very down on his defense and has questions out about his motor that I don't. I think the motor is there. I think the conditioning needs work. But you have Ja, who is almost that good. Like Zion at his peak, Ja is already almost that good. Like he is easily a top five point guard right now. He should be all NBA. This season, there's an argument that he's been the second best point guard in the league. And number one is one of the top 10 players of all time. There's an argument for that. If there's others you'd put, Ja's not falling out of the top three or four. So, and he's 20, 22, 21. At this point, I'd probably say Ja just because there's less risk that comes. Like Zion right now is a risk. What, outside of his fault or not, you don't know how much he's going to be able to play. I don't know if he's Greg Oden, but will he get the development time? Is he ever going to be reliable for more than 60 games a season? And there are players who have actually made that work. One player who has made that work where you're never going to get more than 65 games out of him, but he is just that good, is Joel Embiid. Mm-hmm. But Zion isn't Joel Embiid. Unless he has some massive improvements to part of his games. He could be that. That's the thing, because you can never count on him being that healthy. Zion needs to be Joel Embiid, or you know, that level of impact when he is healthy, for me to kind of see it the other way. Otherwise, I think, yeah, I do have to go Ja. Yeah, what about you?
That is difficult. Like, as a Knicks fan specifically, I should say Ja, because they have never had a point guard anywhere near that level in my lifetime. The best.
Do you think he's already better than Marbury ever was?
Yes, much better. The Knicks did not get the best of Marbury. They got a couple good years from him, and it's not his fault that particularly his second season with the team was pretty awful. But no, Ja Morant is
step on it. Better than peak Marbury? Like if you think Minnesota Marbury was his best, would you say he's better than that?
I would.
That's, I think, just a good question.
I would take where Ja is right now. Steph was never at that level.
Yeah, I agree. And Stephen Marbury was an incredibly talented player. So
yes, he was.
Some have compared Ja to it at times.
Last and perhaps least, we will touch on the Julius Randle thumbs down gate, which seems to me like was pretty quickly a non-story. Julius Randle at the end of Thursday's game against the Celtics, the Knicks heard some boos deservedly in the third quarter when they were down 20 and couldn't get a shot off playing 5-on-4. Randle scored a basket in the fourth, I think, to put them down maybe 4. Crowd is cheering. Randle puts his thumb down. Reporter asks him about it after the game. Randle says, it means shut the fuck up. Implication clear, being that it was directed at the crowd. For all you Met fans out there, it was a delightful walk down memory lane to the Javi Baez, Francisco Lindor thumbs down gate, which really went over well. Randle earlier, I have lost all track of time. Maybe earlier today, Randle on his Instagram?
No, it was yesterday he did the Instagram. Today he got fined.
That's it. Okay.
But on his Instagram, he apologized. And I believe him. He said, that he was very passionate about the team. Sorry, if you wanted to.
I was going to say, I didn't even think he needed to issue a statement. And then the NBA comes out and fines him.
Yeah, that seemed ridiculous. I think the whole thing has been overblown.
Yeah.
I think that Knicks fans who booed, as you mentioned, on a 5-on-4 that was blown, have a right to do that. We don't know what else has been said to him and his family on Instagram and Twitter. People have mentioned that there are people out there who will message family members and players in crossing a line, right? Not criticizing the play, but adding them, whatever. So we don't know the whole story of what he's gone through. But if someone's booing you early in a game and then they're on your side when you're coming back and you thumbs down them, they're competitors, right? Like we've all been in that situation. You've probably been in that situation with family members, right? Like, I've been in situations where my parents would be highly critical of me, and then once I like prove them wrong, and they're like, "Good job," I'm like, "No, like you doubted me, right?" Like we do that with loved ones. I don't think there's anything wrong with what he did. I don't think that says that. And then on the flip side, I don't think there's also anything wrong with Knicks fans booing. That said, booing can be a difficult thing for people. It's tough, right? Because I think I've been just curious to, because I know you've written a lot about, you know, about labor issues and those kind of things. I would be interested in your thoughts, because I think that's just it's an interesting conversation when people talk about professional athletes are labor, right? And should we identify them with like kind of the general labor movement? From that lens, right, if someone comes to your job and boos you, right, like imagine if you're working a regular job and someone pays money and they're like, "I want to watch you work, but I'm going to boo you also if I don't think you're doing a good job." You know, if you're working a regular job, you don't like that. But if I was getting paid $25 million, right, you know, that's different, right? So I'd be curious, like, when you hear about people equating kind of athletes, whether it's LeBron, you know, whether it's like vaccine issues, like it should be my choice, whether it's other kinds of things with, you know, LeBron speaking out about politics, it's a mishmash of things. Where are you kind of on like equating athletes to kind of the general labor movement part of thing?
I think that athletes are workers. And I think there's a certain, I think there's an understanding that athletes possess that I think it's one of the things fans take for granted. And I think now that the status quo is being challenged so much, it's not so much that there's controversy over, you know, what's right or wrong. The controversy really is just stemming from the fact that like something kind of absurd is being exposed. So Julius Randle gives a thumbs down. He didn't, you know, he wasn't sulking around the court. He wasn't, you know, pissing away possession. Like he was 100% engaged and central to that comeback against the Celtics. Julius Randle has been booed many times by fans at Madison Square Garden, a lot. His first year with the Knicks, they sucked and they got booed a lot. And this year they've been booed a few times already. If I remember right, on Christmas Day, they got booed. So once Julius Randle has had a response to X number of boos, X representing something much greater than one, and it's an issue, like, if anything, athletes, I think, the restraint that they show is exceptional. Particularly, and I think New York... This is a tricky discussion not to like just become an idiot about, but I think there is certainly a portion of the fan base that, like, when Phil Jackson was hired at the introductory press conference, like 2 minutes into it, he's talking about the media. And I remember being so like crestfallen because I had seen Phil Jackson coming in as an enormous representation of a culture change. And he sounded to me 2 minutes into it like he's James Dolan's Phil Jackson. I think Julius Randle is like pretty much anybody else. And he's taken most of it. He responded once. It shows he's a human being. I don't think people should need to be reminded of that ever. But if that's what it takes to be reminded, Knicks fans in particular can absolutely deal with one fuck you. Because Patrick Ewing had, in less profane language, had exactly the same complaint. Someone tweeted today a quote from Walt Frazier when he was getting booed and talking about the difficulties of it late in his time with the Knicks. Like, it happens, but what's changing, hopefully more and more, is that the public doesn't purchase an individual's dignity because a private citizen pays them a certain amount of money.
Yep.
Like we don't tolerate that in any facet of society. So I think if anything, the athletes are exceptional for taking as much shit as they do.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So are you against booing? I mean, do you think booing crosses that line?
No, I don't. I do think in the case of Julius Randle specifically, and I see this as a moderator at Posting and Toasting dealing with comment sections, there is a real level of ugliness with some of the stuff that's been said about Randle, either just within the context of as a basketball player, it's been ugly, and certainly in personal stuff that has nothing to do with the game, it's been like not pleasant to deal with the number of people who feel at liberty to say horrible things about this person, who is, I think, maybe 6 months off of being named like NBA's most improved player. And like, I know that doesn't help this year, but even that,
even if he wasn't, right? I mean, there's certain,
but you know, there's something there. So back to that Phil Jackson story, actually had a point to it, which is there is unfortunately a reality, I think, that because of a certain portion, vocal portion of the fan base, like, I really do think that kind of shit works against some people wanting to come here. I think to New York, I think it's a negative factor. You can say like it shouldn't matter, and you can say that like a lot of people, you know, get past that or don't care about it. Like, that's fine. But like, New York is not Los Angeles. New York is not Miami. Like, it's not the primary place to go. If the Knicks are good, they will attract people. But the Knicks have never in the history of their franchise ever signed like the best player in the sport. This kind of shit.
They did get Jeremy Lin as the 15th man on the bench.
They did a nice job with that one. That was close.
For some time, he was the best player in the world.
So. That was close. They got close there. And we saw how that turned out. But yeah, that's
I think that's I would have to agree with all that. And I mean, it's tough to it's just a tough job from that standpoint overall. And it's, I think especially if you, I mean, his older child is just getting to the age where they can read and write. I remember I think it was Michael Beasley who mentioned how he started to for what it's worth, there was an interview where he was talking to a reporter and like he was talking about how his daughter came and told him about some article she had Googled about him that didn't put, you know, because he came to the league at 20 and at 19, did some immature stuff. I don't think Michael Beasley has ever done anything seriously egregious, but you know, he had some maturity issues and he was saying that I don't want my kids to remember any of that like that, right? But in the social media and information age, when your kids can read the stuff that's being written about you, when everyone in your family can, even compared to Ewing's era, I'm sure that's that matters a lot.
Yeah, and in Randall's case specifically, like his kid's right there. Like the kids are sitting courtside. You can argue fairly, like Julius Randle doesn't have a entitlement. He doesn't, you know, you're not entitled to a reality, but it's just like, I don't see what Randle has done. No, see, even that's the wrong thing to say. The stuff that he's responding to, I think, is stuff that there's no justification for. I don't think Julius Randle is thin-skinned. I don't think Julius Randle can't handle being booed, and I think booing is fine. But I think something about it, and like he's going to be more aware of it than anybody else. But like if we've seen shit that we're like, oh, that crosses the line, then he's seen and heard the same shit too. And his children are no one deserves that shit.
Yeah, There is there's one other thing. I know we're a little bit past time. There's one other thing I wanted to ask you. So Evan Fournier has been a bit of a controversial action. Speaking of negative vitriol, that's redundant, I guess. So just vitriol spewed in a player's direction. Evan Fournier has been perhaps on the receiving end of more than at least any other besides Julius Randle, if not more. But there's one opponent who is absolutely torched. That's the Boston Celtics, his former team. But after one or two games, you would think the revenge narrative would go down. Is there something you see, or does it remind you of anyone like that? But, you know, do you think this is just a random thing? But why does Evan Fournier look like Klay goddamn Thompson against the Celtics? And then, you know, maybe not that against nearly everyone else.
Yeah, he was so fun to watch in that game.
All of them. I mean, the first game of the season, he was a big part about why I was so optimistic, because the ball just moves. When he's going, everything goes well, you know?
He's a very different player, but it reminds me of when, and he was only there for a year, but Xavier McDaniel was brought in 91-92, and X was replacing Kiki Vandeweghe, and Kiki could score, but like he couldn't do anything else at that point in his career. And X really struggled for a while as a Knick. He was kind of disappointing the first few months. And there was a weekend game. I think it was against Phoenix. There was some game. It was a Saturday night where he finally hit. Like he just clicked. And they looked like a completely different team. Just that Knick team suddenly having, you know, another guy who was an efficient 20 alongside Ewing and didn't cost you any, you know, rebounding or strength. Fournier, I think, is like a prototype for what the Knicks really wanted the position. Like, there's a better Evan Fournier somewhere, and that's the guy that, like, that should be there. So when Fournier hits, like, they look like what everyone thought they would look like this year. He doesn't usually hit. Xavier McDaniel is my unexpected Evan Fournier comparison. So I think we're good.
Sorry, I was on mute.
Okay.
Just the last, like you said, you mentioned that there's things about Evan Fournier that, you know, there's a better version of him. What like archetype or skill set is that to you? Like what specifically about Evan Fournier's skill set to you do you think is what they eventually want from like the final solution at that position?
I think on the offensive end, they want a person who can, you know, shoot threes off the dribble, can shoot threes off of movement. Who can be effective, you know, attacking a closeout either off the dribble pull up or, you know, maybe not quite the floater game of Quickly, but sometimes I wonder whether Fournier or Quickly is more accurate with their floaters. A guy who the superior version of Fournier would be, you know, someone with a little more athleticism, you know, to be more of a threat when they get near the rim, but. You know, Klay Thompson. Yeah, Sprewell. Klay Thompson, you know, like someone who can, you know, Fournier needs a certain amount of space to do his thing. You know, a superior version of him. He's a decent two guard. He's a decent shooting guard. But I think when he's hitting, like, you know, oh my God, because when he's clicking offensively, he's a lot more than Reggie Bullock was. Like, he's a lot more. They don't have anyone else like him. Depending on who they start at the point, you know, Burks is a very good shooter from three, not a great shooter so much from most other places. Like inside the arc, he's been down this year. They don't have another person like Fournier who, you know, can get it off as quickly. You know, some of those shots he hit against the Celtics, there was one where he caught it inbounds and he's like fading sideways, lets it go. That's not a shot that people make. You know, like quickly could make that shot, I think. But like of the other Nick guards, like, I don't know. Fournier, when he makes it, he looks like, you know, he looks so good. Someone who can create offense and shoot efficiently and, you know, do more than one thing off of a closeout or in a pick and roll. Like, the Knicks are not flush with that in recent years, I don't think.
Is there anything about Boston in particular that you think brings that out? Or just because they have good perimeter defenders, they have an excellent rim protector in Robert Williams, they have Marcus Smart. Yeah. You know, what is it? Why Boston?
Because God is good.
Yeah.
That's all I can think of. I was really looking forward to him playing today to see like what would, you know, happen next in this streak. And I was like, you know, I bet he could go for like, you know, 36 tonight. That would be crazy. Like,
or they're gonna have to revamp their defense so much that someone else is gonna go off as a result, right?
Rarely has anyone been as disappointed as Knicks fans today were to hear specifically that Evan Fournier was not going to play in a game.
Yeah.
Write down.
Cool. But I think that's a pretty good place to call it, unless you had anything else.
No, that's all for now. Knicks are playing next week 3 games. They are playing the Spurs and then the Mavs. On Saturday, they play the Hawks. Hopefully, they can win 2 of those 3. Stacey, anything you want to say before we depart?
No. Don't freak out about this one. We split with the Celtics. That's what's important. Knicks still have everything alive, and exciting times lie ahead.
There you go. Peace, everybody. See you next week.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.